Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're tackling a question that has puzzled scholars for centuries. When was the Book of Deuteronomy written? You've sent us a collection of excerpts focusing on the work of Dr. Robert Van Ooy, and he believes the answer might be hidden in plain sight within the structure of the text itself.
What's fascinating here is that Deuteronomy might be structured like an ancient treaty. Think of it like finding a blueprint that reveals how a building was constructed. We're going to compare Deuteronomy's framework to those of ancient Hittite, Assyrian, and Aramaic treaties, almost like using a literary fingerprint to understand its origins.
So you're saying the way Deuteronomy is laid out, the different sections, and how they connect could tell us something about when it was written?
Exactly.
I have to admit, when I first heard about this approach, I was skeptical, but now I'm really intrigued.
And you should be. Scholar Meredith Klein makes a compelling case. He argues that Deuteronomy shares key elements with treaties from the 14th, 13th centuries BC, right around the time of Moses. If it's right, it would be pretty strong evidence for the traditional view of Mosaic authorship.
Okay, so Klein is saying that Deuteronomy is a product of its time, reflecting the way treaties were written back then. But as you mentioned, there's always another side to the story.
Exactly. Enter scholar Jay Thompson. While he doesn't fully embrace the idea that Deuteronomy was written much later, as proposed by the documentary hypothesis, which, by the way, suggests that the first five books of the Bible were compiled from multiple sources over time, he does have some doubts about Klein's argument.
Wait, hold on a second. Before we get into Thompson's critique, can we back up a bit? For those of us who aren't biblical scholars, could you give us a quick rundown of what this documentary hypothesis is all about?
Of course. In a nutshell, the documentary hypothesis proposes that books like Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy weren't written by a single author, but were compiled and edited over centuries, possibly drawing on multiple different sources.
So it's like a literary puzzle with scholars trying to figure out which pieces came from where and when they were put together.
Exactly. Now back to Thompson. He believes it's possible someone could have written Deuteronomy much later than Moses and intentionally made it look like an ancient treaty. He's not saying that definitely happened, but he's raising the possibility that we might be looking at a carefully crafted literary imitation.
So, like a historical forgery, that's a pretty bold claim.
It is, and Thompson has another point that's worth considering. He says that just because later Assyrian and Aramaic treaties are missing a certain section, the historical prologue, which Deuteronomy does have, doesn't automatically mean that Deuteronomy is from an earlier period.
Okay, so he's saying that the absence of something in later treaties doesn't guarantee its presence in earlier ones. I'm starting to see why this debate is so complex. There are so many factors to consider.
Absolutely. But it gets even more intriguing. Van Ooy, remember him, he counters Thompson's arguments by pointing to a fascinating detail in Deuteronomy, the use of the phrase beyond the Jordan.
Okay, what's so special about that phrase? It sounds pretty straightforward.
It does, but here's the catch. Beyond the Jordan appears in Deuteronomy and seems to be used from both sides of the Jordan River. If you think about it geographically, beyond the Jordan implies a specific vantage point. Shouldn't it be consistent throughout the text?
So you're telling me that this phrase, which seems simple, throws a wrench into attempts to date the book based on location references?
Precisely. Van Ooy uses this to argue against those who say that the phrase points to a later date of writing when the Israelites were already settled in Canaan on the west side of the Jordan.
This is getting complicated. So we have Klein arguing for Mosaic authorship based on treaty structure, Thompson raising doubts and suggesting the possibility of later imitation, and Van Ooy using this beyond the Jordan mystery to support an earlier date. Where do we go from here?
Well, the debate doesn't stop there. We also have to consider the curses in Deuteronomy. Like those ancient treaties, it contains detailed curses for those who break the covenant. And this is where things get even more interesting, because some scholars believe those curses point to a later date of composition.
Okay, I'm all ears. What's the connection between curses and the dating of Deuteronomy?
Scholars like Frankina and Weinfeld argue that the curses found in Deuteronomy are very similar to those in Assyrian treaties from centuries later.
So they're saying Deuteronomy may have borrowed from these later Assyrian texts. If that's the case, wouldn't that push the date of Deuteronomy much later than the time of Moses?
That's their interpretation, yes. But of course, other scholars have a different perspective. Klein and Kitchen, whom we've already met, argue that the language of curses was highly standardized and could remain consistent for centuries.
So it's like legal jargon, certain phrases and formulations are passed down and reused over time. It's hard to imagine that kind of language remaining unchanged for centuries, though.
It might seem that way, but think about it. Even today, we use legal terms and phrases that have been around for centuries. Klein and Kitchen believe that the similarities and the curses don't necessarily indicate borrowing, but rather reflect a long tradition of using specific language for these types of pronouncements.
Okay, I see their point. But honestly, with all this back and forth, I'm starting to wonder if we can really rely on these similarities and differences to pin down the date of Deuteronomy. It feels like every piece of evidence has a counterargument.
You're right to be cautious, and that's what makes it such a fascinating area of study. Just when you think you've got a handle on the debate, someone throws a curveball, like Scholar Nicholson, for example.
Uh-oh, what does Nicholson bring to the table?
Nicholson goes even further than Thompson. He completely rejects the entire treaty covenant analogy as a valid way to understand Deuteronomy. He's basically saying that all those structural similarities we've been discussing are meaningless.
Wow, that's a radical approach. So he's arguing that we should throw out decades of scholarship that has built upon this connection between Deuteronomy and ancient treaties. I'm curious to hear how Van Noy responds to this.
Well, Van Noy, along with Kitchen, strongly disagrees with Nicholson's dismissal. They find the evidence for the connection too compelling to ignore. It's almost as if Nicholson is trying to rewind the clock to a time before the treaty covenant parallels were widely recognized.
So we have a real clash of perspectives here. On the one hand, we have scholars like Nicholson who question the entire framework of the treaty covenant analogy. On the other hand, we have scholars like Van Noy and Klein who see it as a crucial piece of the puzzle in understanding Deuteronomy. It's a reminder that biblical scholarship is rarely about finding definitive answers, but rather about exploring these complexities and engaging in thoughtful debate.
Precisely. And even if we don't arrive at a conclusive answer, the journey of exploration is valuable in itself.
Speaking of exploration, I want to circle back to Thompson for a moment. Even though he has his doubts about using treaty structure to date Deuteronomy, he still seems to lean towards placing it in the time of David and Solomon, which would still be much earlier than the dates proposed by some proponents of the documentary hypothesis.
That's an astute observation. Thompson doesn't fully embrace the late dating, but he's not entirely convinced by the arguments for Mosaic authorship either. He occupies a sort of middle ground.
It sounds like he wants to have his cake and eat it, too.
Perhaps. But remember, Thompson acknowledges the possibility of later additions to Deuteronomy. He specifically mentions the account of Moses' death in chapter 34 as a likely addition.
Well, that seems pretty obvious. Moses couldn't have written about his own death, right?
Logically, no. So, but the inclusion of this account doesn't necessarily invalidate the idea of Mosaic authorship for the rest of the book.
It's like an editor adding a final chapter to complete the story. It provides closure and context without undermining the core message. But what about Thompson's other objections? He doesn't seem to give much weight to the similarities between Deuteronomy and the writings of the prophets.
That's because he argues that it's difficult to determine who influenced whom. Did the prophets draw inspiration from Deuteronomy, or was it the other way around? It's a chicken and egg situation.
Without a clear timeline, that debate might never be settled. But it does raise an interesting question. If Deuteronomy did influence the prophets, what does that tell us about its significance and its place within the broader context of biblical literature?
That's a great question, and it brings us to a crucial point. This debate about Deuteronomy isn't just about one book. It has implications for how we understand the development of biblical literature as a whole.
Okay, I'm following you. How does Deuteronomy connect to this bigger picture?
It acts like a window into the ancient world, showing us how ideas and literary styles developed. If its structure truly reflects those ancient treaty practices, it suggests a level of literary sophistication that might challenge some traditional views of how biblical texts were composed.
Okay, that's fascinating. So Deuteronomy becomes a kind of test case, helping us see the connection between the culture of the ancient Near East and the development of biblical thought.
Precisely. It's like a bridge between those two worlds. And that's what I love about these deep dives. We're not just learning facts, we're uncovering connections that bring these ancient texts to life.
We've certainly covered a lot of ground. We explored the arguments for and against Mosaic authorship, untangled the mystery of the beyond the Jordan phrase, and even waded into the debate over the curses. It's clear there's no easy answer to the question of when Deuteronomy was written. But even without a definitive answer, what's the most important takeaway for our listener?
I think the key takeaway is that studying Deuteronomy, or any ancient text, is a process of exploration and discovery. We've seen how different scholars approach the evidence, how they weigh the arguments, and how they arrive at different conclusions. It's a reminder that biblical scholarship is an ongoing conversation, and there's always more to learn.
It's like we've been given a behind-the-scenes look at how scholars work, how they piece together clues and build their cases.
Exactly. And what's especially intriguing is that this debate about Deuteronomy opens up a whole world of possibilities. If treaty structures can reveal so much about one book, what other ancient forms of writing might hold hidden clues about other biblical texts? It's like a whole field of literary archaeology waiting to be explored.
Now, that's a thought-provoking idea. It makes me want to go digging into all sorts of ancient texts to see what secrets they might hold.
And that's the beauty of it all. This deep dive has not only given us a deeper understanding of Deuteronomy, but has sparked our curiosity to explore further. Who knows what other mysteries are waiting to be uncovered?
Well said. A huge thank you to you, our expert guide, for leading us through this fascinating deep dive. And to you, our listener, keep those questions coming and keep exploring the endless wonders of the ancient world.